You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, France's burkini row continues to the point where it is now comfortably longer than the garments at the centre of it. My guests Mary Dajewski and Michael Goldfarb will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including...
To me, this is something that has to change. And when there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick will probably be spending much of the forthcoming season on the bench anyway, but he's not getting off it for the Star Spangled Banner. Is sitting out the national anthem an effective protest? Uzbekistan acknowledges that the only president it has ever known is mortal. Who or what might follow Islam Karimov? And...
5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
The longest Mars mission rehearsal yet draws to a close, to the audible relief of the participants. But how useful are such dry runs for a mission which won't have an end date? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Goldfarb, the journalist and broadcaster, and Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian. And we will begin in France, where many vexed and important questions about the relationship between church and state, between immigrant communities and host nation, between law enforcement and Islamist extremism, are continuing to be contested via an argument over what women should wear to the beach. Despite Friday's ruling by the Council of State that various municipalities could not ban the burkini, an Islamically correct body cover designed by an Australian, several mayors have announced their intention to enforce the prohibition anyway. Mary, first of all, what does it tell us about France and or life in general that we have ended up with women being persecuted about their clothing in response to religious terrorism almost exclusively committed by men?
Yes, I mean, it is an appalling paradox, isn't it?
It's bizarre.
I mean, I have some sympathy with the French authorities on the matter of secularism. I think the headscarf in schools, that was a big issue, which was a victory for secularism. We looked at laïcité and the way the French sort of enforced the idea, even though it is in fact a pretty Catholic country. Nonetheless, I think that secularism is something that's worth upholding. The burkini, unfortunately, seems to have the absolute worst of every possible world. And here I actually find myself, as it were, on the opposite side, on the side of the people who want to wear the burkini. Because given how separate especially the Muslim communities, a lot of the Muslim communities are in France, given how separate they feel, the fact that at least some of them are going to the beach in the summer and behaving like French people do when they go to the beach in the summer, I think that is to be encouraged. And if banning the burkini stops them going, then I think that is, you know, it's a blow for secularism, which at the same time hinders integration. I think that's a very, very bad thing.
I agree with almost all of that, in that I share your sympathy and indeed France's official sympathy for secularism, and I can understand the imposition of restrictions like that in places which are, I guess, of the state, of university schools, government departments, etc. I cannot myself understand what is going on in the head of anybody who cares in the least or thinks it's any of the state's business what people wear to the beach, Michael.
Well, it brings out long-standing French traditions of governing from the center. They're you know, it's interesting. You know, we talk about the British love of empirical approaches to problems. You know, we look at this, we look at solutions. We have a scientific method, and then we come up with the solution. The French, the British think just ban, but the French are actually trying to use reason as well. They're banning works. Why do something stupid, they say. But on this one, they've completely missed the point. I mean, aside from the fact that the burkini was initially endorsed by none other than Nigella Lawson for other reasons, because it helped, you know, a woman of who have full figures might not want to be walking around in bikinis.
The designer, the Lebanese-Australian designer Aheda Zanetti, says she sells a great many of them to non-Muslims, partly for reasons I'm sure like that, but also you could certainly make the point in Australia that it's extremely sensible beachwear, given that nobody with any sense goes to the Australian beach uncovered anymore.
Exactly. No, I mean, look, I mean, you also have to look at the spread of where these bans have mostly taken place. I mean, if you consider Nice and some of the other towns around. I mean, this is National Front Central. And, you know, there is probably a very quick, hot-to-trot kind of desire to impose some idea of... I doubt Marine Le Pen thinks in terms of laïcité and secularism, but there it is. I mean, her adherents would say, well, this is laïcité and you can't dress in this way on our beach. And in Corsica, of course, they're very strict about a lot of things involving foreigners. They consider the French to be foreigners sometimes. But again, this is a tradition in France, is, you know, all the religions are organized in consistories. They have to report back to the state. There is separation of church and state, but the state actually has an administrative role in the hierarchies of all religions. The Jews and Protestants, or, you know, they have to be in touch with the state. So, you know, there are these mechanisms, and unfortunately the state just got out of control on this. But, you know, look, the court, the Conseil d'État, which is the Supreme Civil Court?
Administrative Court
in French justice. You know, as soon as it got in front of them, they said, that's enough. No, this is stupid. And no, we overturn these bounds. But the municipalities, I mean, what are they going to have? They're not going to have to fight a civil war over this.
But I think it's also worth saying, I mean, it's a very interesting sort of struggle here between the power of mayors and local government, who really fancy their authority in France and who do actually have a large degree of discretion, and the centre, which has told them how to behave, and they're standing back and saying, no, we're not going to do it. But it's also true that although, you know, the burkini issue is sort of special because it has this religious dimension, mayors, especially of seaside cities, they have a quite dictatorial attitude to dress codes. I mean, I remember we lived in France. I was based there and we had a house there for many years. And if you go to the beach, then there is a dress code. There is a dress code off the beach, which comes from the mayor, which says that people will not walk around the streets and the shops and go to the restaurants wearing beachwear. By which they mean short sandals, bikinis, whatever. On the beach, it's exactly the other way around. And if you go, for instance, to a French swimming pool, British men who go in their sort of short style trunks are basically told that they can't go in the water until they change into the Speedo style.
They have to wear Speedos.
They have to wear Speedos. And, you know, that is absolute diktat. And, of course, the local purveyors of French style swimming trunks do very well when the Brits come to town.
And not all of us look particularly fetching in a Speedo. It has to... I mean, I'm willing to admit this on the radio. You can't see me, but I prefer a long boxer,
which is what Michael is wearing now. Is, of course,
I think bikini for men is where it's at, obviously.
Mary, 64%, according to polls, of French people still support the bans. Manuel Valls, the Prime Minister, has said he's in favour. Nicolas Sarkozy, who fancies being president again clearly, said in a recent speech, he said that wearing a burkini is a political act, it's militant, a provocation. Now, my two questions that I would ask in response to that are, one, really? Question mark. And two, if so, so what?
Well, I would add to that a third point, which is the only reason it's become a provocation and political, and you would add to that religious, is because it became an issue and the state decided to take sides. If it hadn't done, it wouldn't be this form of statement. So the problem is now that because it's taken on this significance, it's very difficult for anybody to solve this without one side or the other being seen to back down.
Final thought on this from you, Michael. We've also had, I guess, along similar lines, the tourism minister of India, Mahesh Sharma, suggesting that female visitors to India should not wear short skirts. Now, is that a similar kind of thing, i.e. attempting to police what all women wear, or is this just basically a somewhat, you could argue, ham-fisted advocacy of the when in Rome diktat?
Well, I think it's part, I mean, there's the element of burkini, which is about men telling women what they can wear on the beach. But the French situation very much is also about their ongoing argument in the public space with their Muslim population. And I get what's happening in India. This is much more about the more unfortunately traditional elements of male hierarchy, male patriarchy, policing what modern women can do and modern women can wear. And this follows, of course, some notorious incidents in India in recent years of Western tourists being raped and so on because they allegedly were wearing inappropriate clothing. And I think it's more about bringing the society like India fully into the modern world than, you know, policing what Western visitors should wear.
Okay, well, let's move along now, which we will do by having a listen to this. The national anthem of the United States, of course, there being modestly undersung in the modern fashion. A rousing tune, certainly, but insufficiently so, it seems, to get San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick to his feet before a preseason game at home to the Green Bay Packers this past weekend. Kaepernick sat the anthem out in protest against police treatment of black Americans, explaining that I am not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of colour. Outrage, predictable in tone and content, has ensued, but Kaepernick insists he will continue to sit down during the Star Spangled Banner this coming season, although on form, Blaine Gabbert does look the likeliest starter for the 49ers. Mary, is this an effective protest that Colin Kaepernick has enacted here?
Well, I think it is a pretty effective protest.
Well, we're talking about it, for starters.
Exactly. But also because I think that you do actually notice if someone sits down for the national anthem, and almost particularly an American, because there is this sort of consensus in the US that almost, I would say, is much weaker in Europe and in the UK, where you might not notice, so that it's less valuable as a protest. But I think in the United States, it is very valuable as a protest because it is so against the prevailing consensus.
I think you're entirely right. I think in the context of British football or Australian sports, it would have an impact, but a lesser one. Michael, what do you think? Why is this such a thing in America, where obviously the people who are attacking Colin Kaepernick over this tend to be the people who are most belligerently in freedom of liberty and all that the Stars and Stripes flies for, and here is a man exercising his not to stand up?
Well, it's very interesting because over the last few years, as you know, police violence particularly, and or disproportionately against black people, has become a real problem and topic of conversation. And just to be clear, so far this year, more white people have been shot dead by police in America than blacks, but it's disproportionately skewed towards African Americans being shot. So for me, I was there the first time. In 1968, when we had similar problems between police and African American communities, African American athletes were out front in politics, Muhammad Ali being the best known. Then there was Tommy Smith and John Carlos at the Olympics in 1968, raising the black power, their fists after victory in the 200, I guess it was, and coming third.
It was an Australian athlete whose name I've shockingly forgotten.
But
the
he's the subject of a wonderful film recently.
Yes, he was.
And it's a brilliant story. Anyway, so for, you know, and listen, we just heard that national anthem. I mean, I can remember that both Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin were taken to task in the late 60s for the way they sang the national anthem at opening the World Series or at the, you know, the Super Bowl for throwing blue notes in and, you know, just jazzing it up. Oof, you can't do that. Then protest went away from sport. And in the 90s, 20 years ago, Michael Jordan was famous athlete in the world, famously said, I have no interest in politics. Why? Because Republicans buy sneakers too, and I don't want to offend my potential customers. He's probably a Republican. I don't think he'd like to pay taxes either. His good friend Charles Barkley, another superstar basketball player, said to people, I'm not a role model. He was a very rough player. He said to African-American parents, don't look to me to raise your children. You raise your own children. They were very conservative. And now here we are at the end of the Obama presidency, and we've had a resurgence of violence against African-Americans. And a number of athletes, most famously LeBron James, best basketball player in the world now, have been becoming more political. And Kaepernick has done this. And it's not just the one gesture. I urge people who are listening to check him out on Twitter. His Twitter feed is a serious attempt to curate all manner of reporting on crimes against African Americans committed by police, history, shout outs. He's had a shout out to George Jackson, Soledad brother murdered in San Quentin 40 years ago. I mean, he's a serious person. Unfortunately for Cape, the reason why he's having trouble at the 49ers is that most football players are very apolitical or they're very conservative because it's a quasi-militaristic.
Well, you say that, but to follow that up just briefly, the NFL's response is, well, their official line is that players are encouraged but not required to stand during the anthem. The 49ers have said, we recognize the right of an individual to choose and participate or not, blah, blah, blah. How big a headache does this become for the NFL if this becomes a thing, if more and more black players start making a point of sitting down? And what happens if it's, I mean, Colin Kaepernick is known, he's not at the pinnacle of his abilities right at the moment, but what happens if we start seeing players of the stature of an Odell Beckham or a LeSean McCoy or Russell Wilson taking the same stand?
Well, then it just makes the point. I don't think we're in the same place, although the gestures are similar to what happened in 1968. The society is not in the same place that it was in 1968. And I think that ultimately, will it change anything? Will it change the way the nation is policed? No, but at least it allows, you know, men who have money and fame, which count an awful lot in
American society,
to say this is wrong. And they will get more of a hearing than, say, you know, a group of young students who are in Black Lives Matter occupying the student union at a university.
Mary, beyond sport, is there an obligation or should there be an obligation upon people to participate in such rituals? We had a minor tabloid row here some while ago over the enthusiasm for the current leader of the opposition for Britain's national anthem or obvious lack thereof. Does it matter in the least if a senior politician doesn't sing along, or well, he stood up, I think it's fair to say, at the that particular juncture, but he didn't sing with any great enthusiasm.
No, I think it's rather a difficult problem, and it's to an extent a lesser problem in Britain than in a lot of countries, simply because in my living memory, the occasions when the national anthem is played or sung is vastly fewer now than it was, say, 20, 30 years ago. It used to be every concert, every film, every broadcast, the national anthem was either at the beginning or at the end. It's almost nowhere now, except at international sporting events, occasionally at concerts, usually if the Queen herself is present. So in a way, we've obviated the problem that way. But we also remember how it was in France. Was it the World Cup before last, when the French football team was upbraided by the president for not singing the national anthem before their matches? And there was the inference that they didn't know the words, not that they didn't want, not that they were making a protest, but that they weren't good French citizens because they apparently didn't know the words to the national anthem. And you have to watch. I mean, at the Olympics and at subsequent football matches with the French national team, and I have to say with the British at the last Olympic Games, they were very well versed in their national anthem, and you could see that there seemed to be a sort of team thing, an instruction gone out that they should know the national anthem.
Well, and just in the Olympics just passed, I mean, Gabby Giffords, the American gymnast, African-American girl, I can't call her one, she's so small, she did not sing. She put her hand over her heart. And boy, did she get it on Twitter, because, oh, you have to sing the national anthem. She's from a military family. They don't sing. They put their hands over their hearts. It becomes a symbol of, frankly, fruitless patriotism.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. The Australian sprinter whose name I should have remembered was Peter Norman. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Millett, Mary Dijewski and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up, is Uzbekistan ready for the second president in its 25-year history?
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Mary Dijewski and Michael Goldfarb. Now, since gaining independence in 1991, Uzbekistan has known no rule other than the iron-fisted sort conducted by President Islam Karimov. Reports from the Central Asian country this weekend suggest that Uzbekistan may have to start getting used to the idea. The 78-year-old president has been hospitalised with what his family has confirmed is a cerebral hemorrhage. His condition is reportedly stable, but it is at the very least a reminder that Karimov is mortal, and that the same may apply to the stability, brutally upheld though it has been, that his government has represented. Mary, it is very often the case with your long-serving autocrat types that they neglect to construct any sort of apparatus of succession. Do we have any idea who or what follows Islam Karimov?
Well, I don't think we do, which is really the biggest problem here. Both in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, which are the two biggest countries in Central Asia, which became almost reluctantly independent as the Soviet Union was falling to pieces. They are in identical situations, that they have had the same ruler since just before the end of the Soviet Union. And both Karimov and Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan, they are reaching a point at which their health is going to fail and their rule becomes less tenable. And neither appears to have made preparations for the succession. And interestingly, both have daughters. There are no sons that they can sort of that they can pass on the leadership to, which makes for a very, very potentially very unstable situation in both countries.
Vladimir Putin has been cuddling up a bit to Uzbekistan. I understand that the Russian Federation has forgiven some vast sum in debt. Is there a prospect then of Russia kind of, if not reasserting control, some kind of federalizing momentum from Russia pressing down on these countries that, you know, border Afghanistan? I mean, Uzbekistan we care about because it shares this long border. Well, it's not actually that long, but it shares a border with Afghanistan, and it's a point of access. I mean, during the war to overthrow the Taliban, troops entered in from Uzbekistan. They staged in Uzbekistan. And I just wonder if Putin is planning some kind of federalizing move, refederalizing through diplomacy.
Well, Putin was trying to establish a sort of what he called a Eurasian Economic Union to, as it were, keep together the sort of economic ties that had existed during the Soviet Union, but without, or at least as was said in Moscow, without, as it were, the political constraints that when it was supposed to be more bottom-up than top-down from Moscow. But I think if we look at what's happened in one of the few places where power has changed hands in Central Asia since the end of the Soviet Union, which is Kyrgyzstan. And it's changed about three times, a couple of times violently and unpredictably. And Russia was actually asked to come in. And it actually declined. It said it didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I think the only place where it might potentially be tempted to intervene in some way might be Kazakhstan, because that has a very large number of ethnic Russians. And there have been complaints there that the Kazakhs have been gaining in ascendancy and the Russians are being discriminated against. But I think even there, he'd be very, very careful before committing anything to Central Asian countries.
Okay, well, just finally and briefly tonight, we should talk about these six volunteers who have emerged from a year spent living in a dome atop a Hawaiian volcano, simulating living conditions in a prospective future base on Mars. The six had limited food, water, and communication with the outside world and could not go outside without first donning a spacesuit. It's the fourth and longest such experiment. NASA hopes to establish a Martian base for real in the 2030s. Michael, one of the many questions that occurred to me about this was one of how psychologically useful this actually is, because they could at least count down the years. They could draw little, you know, marks on the inside of their geodesic dome. The people who go to Mars go knowing it's a one-way trip.
Is it?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't think there's an awful lot of mechanism for getting them back once they're there.
Well, you should tell Matt Damon that. I don't know. It's. I suppose, how else are you going to simulate this? But It struck me actually as an odd experiment. I mean, they emerged and it is that knowledge, because if it's meant to be about social and psychological effects of cohabiting in this very extreme environment where you can't exit your protective cocoon, then knowing that your family could come if there was an emergency somehow undermines it a little bit. But, you know, how else are you going to do it? You're just going to ship people up there and after 3 years? What is the one-way trip? 18 months now? Two years?
It's longer than most of us would want to spend with the same five other randomly chosen people, I think. I mean, Mary, how big a threat to any such long-term space exploration of that is just exactly that, whether you can find six people who can stand each other for that long? I mean, I've spent a lot of time around touring rock groups, and at least they get to get out of the bus every so often and interact with other human beings.
I think because all the people who would be doing this are essentially volunteers, and the people who were in the dome in California were also volunteers. At least some of the versions that have come out from participants say that actually there was quite a good amount of sort of give and take and anticipating and body and cooperation, and they do seem to have managed for a year not to have descended into a sort of Lord of the Flies scenario and into New Sign warfare and breaking out of the dome.
Nobody emerged with a pig's head on a stick or anything.
Have they worked out how to get really good broadband up on Mars? I mean, if you were stuck for a year with people, you know, if you had good broadband connection, you would be okay.
There is only so much Monopoly you can play, isn't there?
But I think your tasks are different, because one of the tasks they apparently had was to sort of find water out of nowhere. And they say that they managed to find water and they might be able to do so on Mars.
Well, on that happy thought, that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Mary Dujewski and Michael Goldfarb, thank you very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Rhys James and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Molly Ingleby. Our studio manager was George McDonough. There's more music next at 1900. It's The Culture Show with Rob Bound, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.